very much, Kavitaka. Once upon a time, in faraway India, in the country known as Madhya Desha, the middle country, near the town of Kapilavastu, there lived a boy, born to a good family. He was a very gifted lad, and when he was only 11 years old, he left his home and became an ascetic wanderer. Where's Kion? 11. When he was 11 years old, he left his home and became an ascetic wanderer, taking the name Mrutyabodha, which means wise about death, at 11 years old. In his wanderings, he entered the great centres of learning, the great monastic universities. After about 10, 12, 15 years of wandering, he studied with the great Naropa. We heard about him a while back. On the first week, those of you who were here, and learned all there was to know about the perfection of wisdom and Madhyamaka, the middle way school. He studied with other great teachers all there was to know about mantra and tantra, and he became eventually a Buddhist monk named Maitri Gupta, the protector of love, or loving protector. And he intensively practiced meditation on Tara, green Tara, reciting her mantra no less than 10 million times. So by this time he's not 11 anymore, he's grown up. He's well into his 20s, maybe even his 30s. And one night during his intensive meditation on Tara, he fell asleep. And in his sleep he heard a voice which said, "Go to Karsalpana." Karsalpana was a place. Karsalpana literally means sky gliding. It's also the name of the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. So he went to Karsalpana and stayed there for a year. And again he heard words spoken in his sleep saying, "Go, noble son, go southwards to the two mountains, to Manubhanga," which means the destruction of the defiled mind, "and Chitta Vishrama," which means where the mind comes to rest. Go to the mountains, Manubhanga and Chitta Vishrama. The Lord Shabara dwells there, and he will become your preceptor. And on your way, on your journey, you will meet a man named Sagara, whose name means ocean, a prince from China. Go along with him too. And so he wandered south, this Maitri Gupta, following the word spoken in dream to find the mountains of Manubhanga and Chitta Vishrama, to find the Lord Shabara. On his way, he did meet a prince of China named Sagara, and together they wandered for over a year in their search for the mountains. At one place they stopped, and Maitri Gupta meditated again on the noble Tara for a month. Again a voice spoke to him in a dream saying, "Go, noble son, to the two mountains standing in the northwesterly direction, which you can reach in 15 days. Because of the words the good lady had spoken to him, he went northwest, joining a caravan of travellers going that way. After 15 days, he met a man who told him that the next day he would reach the intersection of the two mountains, Manubhanga and Chitta Vishrama, and it would be easy to stay there. Hearing this, the renowned scholar, the devoted scholar Maitri Gupta, was joyful. And the next day he arrived with his companion. He arrived in a beautiful place. The two mountains loomed either side of him, and they were dense with trees and vegetation, green and lush. There were flowering creepers and streams and pools. He caught sight of the deer darting along their forest paths. He could hear the wild boar and tigers at night time, the call of the birds. He made offering mandalas to the Buddhas in gratitude for arriving at this place his dream had spoken of. He felt happy, ecstatic, contented. The days passed, and he and Sagara lived on wild radishes, fruits and fresh water from the streams. But he found no one. There seemed to be no one there. No Lord Shabara, no hermit, no hermitage. Just wild forest all around. Though he meditated and entreated the noble lady Tara Nothing happened. Sometimes he did hear. Did he hear? Did he hear singing? What was that sound? Uccha uccha pabata tahu basai sabari bali morangi picha parahina sabari gibata gunjari mali. Higher and higher in the mountain the Shabara girl lives. This Shabara nymph flaunts a peacock's feather, around her neck a garland of red gunja berries. Did he hear that? No, did he? He didn't hear it. And then laughter, and another voice. And was this a woman's voice? Umata sabvaro paggala, sabvaro ma karaguli guhada, to hauri nihagaring, name sahaja sundari. You crazy Shabara, you drunken Shabara, don't raise a ruckus or cause such a commotion. I'm your own wife, named Lady Naturally Beautiful. Did he hear that? Or was it just the sounds of waterfalls echoing and birds calling? It was all so tantalising. Where was this Shabara, this Lord Shabara, who would be his preceptor? This so-called guru, a tribal fellow, after all. His name Shabara meant savage or tribal. He'd heard on his journeys the story about Shabara, how he was a hunter who lived in the mountains, who would track the wild deer on their hidden paths, who knew all their ways, who would kill with his deadly arrows, who lived on their meat and wore their skins. One day, the stories went, as he walked the forest path, another hunter came into view. Like Shabara, he wore deerskin. Like Shabara, he had a bow, arrows, hunting knives. Like Shabara, he had long hair and a full beard. Shabara was suspicious. This was his mountain, his forest. And when they went on the path, Shabara said, "Who are you?" And the hunter said, "A hunter like you. Where are you from?" "Oh, from very far away." Shabara's blood was suddenly up. "How many deer can you shoot with a single arrow?" Shabara could kill quite a few deer with a single arrow under certain conditions. He was that good a hunter. "Oh, let me see," the stranger said. "I can kill about 300 or so with a single arrow." "What? I'd like to see you try." "All right, I'll show you tomorrow," said the stranger. 300. The next day, the two of them met, and the stranger led Shabara out of the forest to a great plain. Shabara had never been to this place before, and there were deer, a great herd of them. There must have been 500 of them. Shabara had never seen so many. It was all very strange. But he recovered his hunter's pride and said, "How many will you kill?" "All of them," came the reply. Shabara was a bit disturbed by the stranger's confidence and suggested that maybe he'd just kill 100. "All right," said the stranger. Everything became very still. The stranger took up his bow, aimed, everything became focused, and then he let the arrow loose. It flew through space, and then suddenly 100 of the deer had fallen to the ground. The two of them went to where the deer lay. Shabara was amazed, and the stranger said, "They're yours, have them. Why not take one home?" Shabara was well used to hefting a great deer over his shoulders. He was very strong, but he couldn't lift this one. He just couldn't do it. Suddenly Shabara's pride broke. He knew that this stranger must be one of those great magician hunters that he'd heard about in legend, and he bowed down and begged him to teach him his powers. So the stranger said he would, but Shabara would need to prepare for the teaching. He would have to practice meditation. He would have to practice a meditation where he extended loving kindness to all that lives. He would also have to give up killing and eating meat. He would have to be vegetarian, and he'd have to do this for a whole month. So Shabara meditated on loving kindness. He stopped killing and eating meat. He lived on roots and berries and fruits. It was easy because he was so keen to be a great hunter. He was imagining killing 500 deer with one arrow while he carried on with his loving kindness meditation and his vegetarianism. After a month, the stranger returned and he could see that Shubhra was ready. They sat together on the ground and the stranger drew a mandala, a magic circle in the dirt. He strewed flowers onto the mandala and murmured some mantra. And then he asked Shubhra to look in the circle. Shubhra looked and became transfixed by what he saw. He couldn't move. He was terrified. He'd never felt fear before. "Tell me what you see," said the stranger. "What do you see? Tell me." "I see myself," said Shubhra. "I see myself burning in some terrible place. It looks like a kind of hell." "Are you afraid?" said the stranger. "Yes." "Do you want to be free of that fear?" "Yes." "Will you do what is necessary?" "Yes, I surely will." The vision faded, and the stranger told him that what he had seen was the effects of killing, what it leads to, how it leads to so much suffering. And Shubhra responded keenly, and so the stranger revealed to him the Dharma. He taught him how to meditate on Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, with 11 heads and 1,000 arms. A form of Avalokiteshvara actually holds a bow and arrow. And after 12 years, Shubhra became one with compassion. He attained Mahakaruna, the compassion that springs from emptiness, the compassion that makes no distinction between self and other, the compassion that is natural, that is easy, that just flows, that is uncontrived. This was the story that Maitri Gupta recalled. People also said that the stranger who'd come for Shubhra, the strange hunter figure, was none other than Lokeshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion himself, and that Shubhra's realization was so great, he had become Lokeshvara himself. It was also said that Shubhra would never die. He'd taken a vow to always dwell in the world out of compassion, that you could always find him hidden away in the mountains, singing his songs of realization. "But I haven't found him," thought Maitri Gupta. "They're just stories after all." And he was full of longing. He decided on one last try, one last effort to entreat the Lord Shubhra. There were those strange voices after all. He found a spot high up that looked down over the forest slopes, and he began with a fast for 7 days. Didn't eat a thing, just took water. And he sat cross-legged in meditation. And he vowed that "I will take my own life if I do not meet Lord Shubhra." At the end of 7 days, apart from a little dream sign, there was nothing. He felt despair and humiliation. He devoted his whole life to study, to learning, to devotion, to meditation, and for what? To end up following a dream. To end up following a voice he heard in his dream. And here he was on this mountainside in the middle of nowhere, and there was nothing there. He decided that there was nothing for it but to take his own life and hope for a good rebirth. He took a knife to slit his throat. And then, of course, the Lord Shubhra appeared. There he was, a yogi, but dressed like a hunter. He had long, glossy black hair and a lovely black, shiny beard. He had keen, really keen, loving eyes, and he was wearing the skin of a deer. Maitri Gupta was ripe and ready for the Dharma. He'd done all the necessary work on himself so Shubhra could come, and Shubhra initiated him, taught him meditation, and gave him a new name. He said, "You are now Advaya Vajra, the non-dual Vajra. So the two of them, Shabara, the yogin, the embodiment of Lokeshvara, and Advaya Vajra, practiced together on the mountains. And Shabara unfolded the Dharma to Advaya Vajra, not just through instruction in meditation and visualization, and not just through using words. There were days when Shabara would just take up his veena, he would sit cross-legged on a rock, and he would just play all day, just play music. There were no need for words, there was no need for talk. He would just play his music, and somehow, hearing the music, Advaya Vajra would understand. All aspects of the Dharma would enter into him through the sound of the veena. And sometimes Shabara would sing his songs of realization, songs like, "In the forest of unknowing lurks a deer, the deer called alienation. Drawing back the great bow of means and wisdom, letting fly the single arrow of ultimate truth, the deer dies, yes, thought dies. Then the flesh is a feast of non-duality. The flavour is a taste of pure pleasure, and the goal, the magnificent stance, is accomplished." So Advaya Vajra practiced, and one day, Shabara decided to test his disciple, test his realization, test whether he really did see the illusory nature of things. So Shabara ordered Advaya Vajra to kill his companion Sagara. We haven't heard much about the Prince of China, but apparently he was still around. He ordered Advaya Vajra to chop him up and then put him back together again, just to show that he had mastered illusion. So the word of the guru was not to be disobeyed. Advaya Vajra cut Sagara down, but he couldn't put him back together again. I tried to. And Advaya Vajra said, "Guruji, I can't put him back together again. Why can't I put him back together again?" And Shabara said, "It's because you have not realized non-duality. You still have thoughts that create self and other." And Advaya Vajra said, "But what is to be done? Please, Guruji, instruct me." Shabara said, "You won't gain siddhi in this life. Go and do teaching back at your monastery." "But how can I do that, Guruji? I am incapable of living like that. I want to be here with you." "In this life, you will do it through teaching. Teaching the sadhanas and tantras of Vajra Yogini, and that will bear fruit." And suddenly he vanished, leaving Advaya Vajra between the mountains all alone. We don't know what happened to Sagara. Presumably he disappeared or got put back together again. Leaving Advaya Vajra between the mountains all alone, contemplating his long, lonely journey back to his monastery to follow the command of his Lord Shabara. And hearing. Did he hear it? Did he hear a song again? "It's not about wealth or wild animals or young wild boar. It's not about a beautiful woman with a face like the full moon. Ah, because those people with longing are just a construction of signs, the Lord Shabara dwells on top of the mountain." There's a strange dreamlike quality to the story of Advaya Vajra. We seem to be in that world of twilight language, of Sandhyabhasa, which so many tantric works and stories and songs are written in. In the twilight, objects that were familiar in the clear light of day appear to be something else. You see a cat moving ahead of you only to find that it's a stump. In the twilight, things are not as they seem. There's a blending, a blurring of shape. Twilight is a time when dimensions meet and blend and merge, and you need another key to understand what is there. Advaya Vajra's story is actually a mythic description of spiritual life, of the Siddha's path. He starts off early, 11 years old, and becomes a wanderer named Mrityabodhi. In fact, all of his names seem to have a symbolic meaning. Mrityabodha, wise about death. He goes forth, he renounces the world, he has all the idealism of youth. It brings up the basic Buddhist practices of renunciation, going forth, going for refuge, not relying on the uncertain world. He studies then with the great teachers of the day. He develops a deep and personal connection with the female Bodhisattva Tara, the quintessence of love and compassion. And he is ordained as Maitri Gupta, loving protector, which evokes the Bodhisattva path. He realizes that spiritual life is not just about saving himself, obtaining nirvana for himself. It's about loving others, helping others to practice, and opening up to the Bodhisattvas. So this is the way we can approach things. We start off idealistic with a call for a deeper meaning. We work on ourselves personally, but then we realize that we have to open out to others and we have to open up to the Bodhisattvas. Clearly, he is a very devoted practitioner come scholar, which would seem to be a particular kind of life. There's a number of characters like this in medieval Indian Buddhism. And it's interesting that he's so devoted to green Tara. I remember Sangharakshita telling me that when he took the green Tara initiation from Chatral Sungye Dorje, a great yogi, a kind of modern Mahasiddha, really, he just said to Banti, "This is the sadhana of all the great pandits, all the great scholars of India, green Tara." And then he said, "Very good for intellectuals." Advaivadra is an intellectual, not in a one-sided way, because clearly he has great faith and devotion to Tara. Oh, he does, after all, practice intensely, 10 million mantras to Tara. He's going along very well in his monastery, in his spiritual life. But something deeper calls to him, calls from another level entirely, calls in his sleep, in his dreams, calls in the space where you can't make it happen yourself. And the call doesn't come with well-packaged ideas, but calls enigmatically. Go to Karsapana, which could be a place, but it means sky gliding. Could it mean it's saying go and glide in the sky? Or it's also the name of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. He goes there. Maybe it's an actual place. Maybe it's a spiritual state. Maybe it's both. But he goes there. He goes to sky gliding. And here, after a year again of practice, he's told again in his sleep to go south to the mountains between Manobhanga, which means the destruction of the defiled mind, and Chitta Vishrama, where the mind comes to rest. South he has to go, to the mountains. Again, this could be an actual place, or a state like lofty mountain peaks, where all duality has been destroyed, and where the mind is at peace and at rest. It's no longer prapanchizing, proliferating. Remember that term, prapancha. He follows his intuition. He meets a companion, as predicted, a prince of China named Sagara. No doubt that's symbolic as well. We'd have to find out what a prince of China would mean to the medieval Indian imagination. A prince of China named Sagara, who is only mentioned again when he's chopped up. Sometimes wonder if he could have been called Samudra, because that also means ocean. Thought I'd throw that in. Not that we want to chop up Samudra Dharma or anything like that. Because we wouldn't be able to, no, anyway. I wouldn't have a secretary anymore. It's a long journey, this journey between the two mountains. It's a long journey into unknown land. And at last he reaches the forests of the mountains, and he waits for Shabara. Shabara, whose name means tribal, it's the name of a particular tribal group. or it could mean savage. Spiritual life, Buddhist life, is like that. We begin at whatever age with idealism, hope, ideas. Maybe we too have some faith, some devotion. We have some dissatisfaction, some questioning. Inevitably, our approach at first is strongly intellectual. Now, this might surprise some of you. I'm sure many of you don't regard yourselves as intellectuals. I certainly don't regard myself as an intellectual. But in a way, at first, in spiritual life, we're all intellectual. For the very simple reason that there is a disparity between our understanding and our actual experience. Intellectually, rationally, we know what to do. We know that it's better to love and not to hate. Very simple, that. Intellectually, we know that. Intellectually, we know it's better to get up in the morning and meditate and not lie in bed, especially on retreat. Especially on the last day of a retreat. Intellectually, we know all these things. But we fail so often. So much of us, the rest of us, just lags a long way behind our understanding, which is also blended with our faith too. It's not just head stuff. There's a bit of heart in there as well. But the rest of us lags behind. There's that wonderful insight of Zangarakshita's in one of his early lectures, which is just so simple and so true, always bears repetition and reflection upon, where he says the central issue of spiritual life for most people is to develop the emotional equivalent of their intellectual understanding. That's the central issue of spiritual life. Maybe we're even very devoted. We do puja. We love bodhisattvas. We're emotionally involved. But still, our understanding and even our faith and devotion is ahead of our experience. Advaivadra, his intellect and faith, they're both very well developed. He's really motivated. And they're taking him somewhere, no doubt. He's going deeper. You know, more than 20 years of practice. And of course, he is brilliant. He's a brilliant scholar. He knows everything. He's got incredible intellectual sophistication. I mean, the Buddhist scene in medieval India, if you were a pandit, you were top-notch out there, you know, rarefied intellectuals, incredibly refined. Dominant among that would be the Majjhimaka kind of perspective on things. You know, this incredible sort of incredibly subtle and devastating what kind of Buddhist skepticism, really, kind of critique of every single position that things are neither existent nor non-existent, not both or neither. You can't say anything about anything. And the perfection of wisdom and the Madhyamaka tirelessly talk and talk to expose that. You can't even say it's nihilism either. That would be a stance, a wrong position, by the way. Intellectually, Advaivadra will have come to the end of his mind, but only intellectually. Intellectually, and I've been doing this throughout this retreat, intellectually, we can stand for hours and say that reality is beyond the intellect and show the arguments. We could go through all the arguments. But it remains intellectual, saying, well, it's beyond words. That's an idea. That's just talk. It's an idea. It's an idea about the idealess. We might even get incredibly excited about it. Sometimes like this in study groups, you know, or, you know, the late night chat, you know, maybe with too much coffee or some other substance. Get very excited about Yogacara and Madhyamaka and say, well, you know, in the end it's beyond words, man. Wow! And everybody's getting really excited. You know, we go, this is the perfection of wisdom. But it's an idea. It's a stance. The constant overturning of any philosophical position is just words. It's just an idea. And our excitement is the excitement generated by ideas. It's not getting an insight into it. It's the excitement generated by ideas. Which
you know, is not a bad thing, I guess. When the path stops, when the words stop, the forest begins. And the forest is suddenly interesting, precisely because it's baffling and confusing. Where the words end, the forest begins. And in the forest is the mountain man, the tribal, the hunter, and his mountain woman. Here are deer and birds and riotous vegetation. Here are songs echoing down the mountainside. Where the words end, where the ideas end, where the desire to know, to label and to control, to order and to even to attain, where the idea that the path is a straight white track, where that ends, where the idea that it's clearly signposted ends, where expectations end, and where the idea that it leads to a heaven, which we designate nirvana, ends. When all that ends, we enter the mountains. We enter the forests of symbols. We enter the twilight, where the labelling, controlling mind, where our ideas of spiritual life end, where they just don't work anymore, where we've run out of tricks, where we've run out of our tricks about how to get ourselves into dhyana, for example, where we've run out of our tricks about how we're going to attract the guru. When we run out, we enter the forest of symbols. Shabara is the tribal, the huntsman. He's not going to come at your beck and call. He's not going to come just when you want him to. This is what it's like sometimes. You know, we come on retreat, we go to a class, we turn up for a meditation and puja, and we've got all these ideas of what it's going to be like. We're going to have this experience, that experience. We're going to get this, we're going to get that from the order members or whoever. Well, really? You know, these higher, deeper dimensions aren't going to come just because of, you know, you fancy them coming along. Oh no, no chance. You have to wait and you have to give up. You have to let go. You have to become hopeless. Hopeless. You have to let go of hope, which is a very different thing from faith. Very, very different thing. You have to get rid of hope in the sense of that expectation, the controlling, ordering and labelling mind has to utterly cease. Only then will Shabara come. Only then will he come and consecrate you and tell you your true name, your primordial name. And even when he teaches you, it's not like you've been taught ever before. You know, you can't use that mind that you've used for years to understand. He only instructs you. He tells you a bit, but he generally plays his veena and he sings his songs. And there he sits with his long black hair and wild eyes and dark skin, and you can't fathom him at all. He's from outer space. He's from Outer Space Ways Incorporated. And who's this woman he keeps singing of all the time? He's singing these sort of love songs about this woman and you never see her. You hear sort of funny voices sometimes, but you never see this woman, and he's obviously so in love. And he's singing his love songs. He sings his songs of love and longing and lovemaking. And, you know, sometimes you seem to see the woman yourself. Something comes through. You seem to kind of picture her. She's so vivid. And he's so fascinating. And strangely kind. And he's very strange and wild. And completely uncontainable and untrammeled. But unfathomable. But very kind, and his effect on you is so magical that when he tells you to chop someone up to demonstrate illusion, you do. You're completely entranced. But when you can't put them together again, he tells you that it's because your mind is still separating self and other, and that you'll never attain siddhi, so you should go back and teach. Go back to the world, because that will bear fruit, and you will benefit many. You don't want to go. But he just vanishes and leaves you. And you hear the echoing song that Shabara will never leave the mountain. and you know it's time to return, to go back, to be in the world again, the world of ideas, of, as it were, ordinary reality. But you know you're not going to be in that world in the same way, because the forest is in you and Shabara is with you. The medieval Indian imagination gives us the picture of the great Siddha, the awakened man, not as a monk in neatly pressed robes, not as a celestial bodhisattva in ornaments and silks, but as a tribal man, a natural man, dwelling in the forests and on the mountains. The terms for the high state that the Mahasiddhas sing about and tell us about is all about being natural and easy. We've been using the word sahaja a lot, meaning innate, natural, easy. There's also the term nija, which means something like native. And kritrima, which means non-artificial. And they all indicate the space at the end of conceptualization. They fill it with images and stories. They fill it with twilight language. We've heard a lot of them over this last week, over this last 2 weeks. But the story of Shabara on his mountain is for me the most beguiling, the most attractive. And I'm not even sure I can fully articulate why. His wildness isn't a raving wildness. It's not like that. It's untrammeledness. It's like it's that quality that one of the Buddha's disciples says when he sings out. There's this disciple of the Buddha who just every so often just starts saying, "Oh, sukha! Oh, bliss!" He just sings out like this. And the monks complain to the Buddha. They say, "Well, he's thinking about his past life when he lived as a king. He's not doing it properly. You know, he's dwelling on his past. He hasn't gone forth properly." So the Buddha calls the monk to him and he says, "Is it true that you keep calling out, oh bliss?" He says, yeah, it's true, Bhagavan. "And is it because you're thinking of your past?" He said, "Oh no. He said, in the palace, there were all these guards to protect me and it was awful. I felt so enclosed. But he said, here, dwelling in the forest, I feel so happy. And my mind is so happy. I feel like some wild thing. I feel like some deer that just goes its way. That's why I say, oh, sukha." So Shabara is like that. It's the untrammeled mind. It's that kind of wildness. There's also this image of the hunter, I think, is very good. Shabara, although he doesn't hunt deer anymore, he still has that intense concentration, that intense kind of uncanny in-tuneness with the way things are in the forest. But he can, you know, he's reached the point where he can just have that and just enjoy and appreciate. When I was thinking of this, I was thinking of that incredible scene in the film The Deer Hunter, where Robert De Niro, towards the end of the film, goes hunting and he tracks the deer, and he's an amazing tracker and hunter. And then the deer appears in its glory. And he deliberately misses, and he just calls out. And it's a great moment in the film, because there's this wonderful feeling of, you know, he sees beauty, he sees freedom after everything he's gone through. So this is the kind of quality, this untrammeled, free, fresh, natural quality. I think, though, having said about Shabara, I think my first vision of somebody like Shabara happened in the city. This is something I wrote many years ago, called Bombay Night. I was in a taxi going to the airport. The night was hot and steamy, a typical Bombay night. At Mahim, by the shrine of the Muslim saint, we were caught in a huge, chaotic traffic jam. Exhaust fumes, car horns, the inviting lights of the shrine, and then I heard the drumming. It was the Urs, the death ceremony of the saint. Processions of Kalandars were coming to pay their respects. Behind me, the drumming grew louder. Turning my head, I saw a group of tall, strong men, powerful men, with long hair and beards, dancing violently to the pounding of the drums. One of them held a huge axe which he was swinging at his bare chest. Another was swinging a wheel of nails which span dangerously close to his skin. They were working themselves into an utter frenzy. But behind them, I saw other men. They leaned against a black taxi. They seemed to be waiting, watching. They were looking on at this scene with dignified detachment. They looked more truly wild than the frenzied dancers. Oh, how I remember those strong-looking men leaning on a black taxi that night in Bombay. Those dark-skinned men with long black hair and soft beards, in green check sarongs and long white shirts, looking out on the city from some distant, wild place. Those wandering lovers, smitten with the violence of love. Maybe it's time. Time to go far away. Time to follow those strong, handsome men. Time to follow the music of love. Time to give myself to him. So I think that might have been my first sight of Shubhra. And Shubhra is always singing to his nymph. She dwells high in the mountain, inaccessible, unknowable, with her peacock feather stuck in her hair and red gunja berries around her. She's probably wearing a grass skirt. She's very natural and very youthful and very experienced. And she's totally in tune with the ways of the forests and mountains. I must say, this picture, this image, this vision is much more appealing to me than red Darkanese with their choppers and things like that. The vision of Shubhra's nymph. And she tells Shubhra, when Shubhra sings to her, not to make a commotion, not to make a ruckus, because she is his wife. She's always with him. She is him. Shubhra's beautiful maiden is him. She's Sahaja Sundari. She's the beauty of the natural, the beauty of the innate, the beauty that's there. There's no need to go looking for her, no need to go looking outside. She's there always. She's there and she's not there. She's promiscuous. You're promiscuous. When the labelling ends, when the dualistic mind ceases, when the crust of mental proliferation ceases, we're always making love. There's nothing between self and other, nothing between inside and outside. We're always making love. What is seen and heard and smelt and tasted and felt and imagined is utterly delicious and voluptuous. This is endless delight and bliss. Who needs sex when experience is constant, mutual delight? This is wisdom. This is love. The entire world is the forested mountains. You can never get out of the forest. You can never get out of the mountains, says Shubhra. You don't want to, because it's all here. The forests, the natural, beautiful maiden. She's in you and around you. The forest is in you and around you. And so you play, touching others, whoever you come into contact with, loving others, showing them the way to the forest, showing them their inner wisdom maiden, who you sing of endlessly. Higher and higher in the mountain the Shubhra girl lives. This Shubhra nymph flaunts a peacock's feather and a necklace of red gunja berries. She says, you crazy Shubhra, you drunken Shubhra, don't raise a ruckus or cause such a commotion. I'm your own wife, Sahaja Sundari, the beauty of naturalness. Various beautiful trees are in bloom. Their branches reach the sky. The Shubhra girl, a Vajradhara, wearing earrings, wanders the forest alone. Shubara prepares the entire cosmos as his bower. The bed of Mahasukha, great bliss, is made ready, for this Shubara is the real lover. With Lady Selflessness as his love, he lights up the night. Afterwards, he chews the essential betel nut of mind and the camphor of great bliss, and empty non-self enters his throat. Great bliss lights up the night. Hey, Shubara, with your guru's word as your bow, pierce the mind with your arrow. Pierce, pierce, highest nirvana. That crazy Shubara has wandered into the ravine between the high mountain peaks. How will this Shubara ever get out?